if you're innovating, creating, or making a difference.
This show is for you. Welcome to Over Coffee. I'm Dot Cannon. Here on Over Coffee, we talk with artists and innovators about the process of changing the world in terms of what they do.
With connected vehicles, we're focused on what kind of ways can we transmit data from stoplights, street lamps, to vehicles. In addition to the fact, like when you're going around a blind curve, how can vehicles transmit their information and their location?
Rourke Petullo is the co-founder of the University of Michigan's Michigan Applied Robotics Group. With one of the top robotics programs in the nation, University of Michigan's curriculum includes the development of autonomous vehicles. In 2015, UM opened a 32-acre facility called M-City, which simulates both urban and suburban environments for the testing of self-driving cars. Rourke, who will receive his Bachelor of Engineering degree in Electrical and Electronics Engineering in 2020, is the Vice President of UM Autonomy. He was also a panelist at the 2017 Sensors Expo in San Jose in June for their Automotive and Autonomous Vehicle Sensors Workshop. Rourke, before we get to talking about the Michigan Applied Robotics Group and all the cool stuff that you're doing there, I'd like to know a little bit more about you. What do you remember very best about your growing up years that first sparked your interest in robotics and ultimately autonomous vehicles?
So my background in autonomous vehicles really came out of automotive. The entire time my dad was growing up, he was from a really poor family, and GM put him on a scholarship and put him through school. Ultimately, what that meant was the entire time that I was growing up, my dad was in corporate fleet leasing. So corporate fleet leasing is companies like Geek Squad, where Best Buy doesn't actually own all of those Volkswagens. They're on a 2 to 3 year lease where a company will manage all the gas cards, all the maintenance, all the roadside assistance. And so really what that resulted for me was not only talking about what do individual vehicles make possible for consumers, but what happens on an industry-wide market. And so initially what had happened was my dad had had a Chevy Volt of all things. I thought it was the coolest car in the world. And so I initially went to Michigan with the intention of doing electric vehicles. But ultimately when I got there, M-City, which is the self-driving test facility on campus, had just opened up. And I saw a lot of the opportunities that were happening there. And so I pivoted to focusing on autonomous vehicles. And it has absolutely piqued my interest. And I think it's probably what I'm going to end up doing for the rest of my life.
Take me inside of M-City in our imagination. I understand that opened in 2015. What are they doing there right now?
So M-City started as the University of Michigan's public-private partnership with a variety of partners, ranging from the automakers like Ford and GM to telecom like Verizon, all the way to even insurance companies like State Farm. Basically, autonomous vehicles has become this great unknown for all the parties involved. And so they'd all like to have kind of a heads up and see what technologies are going to stick, and really, how is this going to shape the way that Americans drive? And not only just Americans, but around the world, how is it going to change from country to country? And so UMCity exists as a fake neighborhood that has a basic plot of urban as well as a simulated highway environment. So to be able to test situations everywhere from filling an environment with virtual cars and essentially tricking these self-driving vehicles into saying, how do I interact with a variety of individual pedestrians, bicyclists, or other cars on the road? And similarly, how do I deal with that when I'm facing with all kinds of situations, whether it be losing GPS coverage, or I'm facing a situation where I don't have direct line of sight and I have to use other resources within the environment in order to detect what's around me and provide the safest environment for the riders of the vehicle.
So far, what does it look like is going to stick in terms of one or two technologies that we're probably going to see in the self-driving cars of, let's say, 2027?
Right now, one of the biggest things that we're facing in the self-driving world is cost. So many of these technologies are just emerging from the research realm and going towards industry. And so as you've seen with companies like Tesla, they're really focusing on how do I use cameras and computer vision to understand the environment around me. And they're using that with an integration of radar just to say, where are objects, even if I can't tell exactly what they are. That's what's most cost effective right now, which is why Tesla's using that technology. A couple of the technologies that are on the horizon are the technology called LiDAR. And for those who don't know what LiDAR is, it's the same thing as, say, sonar on a sub, where you're bouncing waves back and forth and interpreting it as an image. But LiDAR does it essentially with 1,000 small laser pointers. And it creates all these individual dots in your environment, and you're able to read that back as a three-dimensional image. And so LiDAR historically has been very expensive, but with upgrades in the recent technology, we're getting from the point of where a LiDAR was, say, $8,000 for one of these sensors, all the way down to where we're looking at $400 or $500 for one of these sensors. Not only are they cheaper, but they're also becoming more effective. And so by the time we get to 2027, you're going to see that work in tandem with cameras, not just alone as individual sensors.
A car sending light pointers and working with cameras. Wow.
One of the other things that we're dealing with is, you know, a lot of the focus has been what's going to go on the cars themselves, but the most recent focus at the University of Michigan are what are the technologies that are going to be in the environment to help drivers. So, you know, when you're driving your car as an individual, you're entirely relying on your senses. But with connected vehicles, it has opened up the possibility of having different sensors in the environment. And so we're focused on what kind of ways can we transmit data from stoplights, street lamps to vehicles. In addition to the fact, like when you're going around a blind curve, how can vehicles transmit their information and their location to other vehicles within a 1,000-foot radius so that you have more time to react as a driver? And so what we're really trying to focus on is, all right, what are the sensors that are going to be on the vehicle themselves, or well as what other opportunities exist that we can really help drivers that have not previously been available?
This is going to be incredible to get a chance to experience. Tell me, please, about co-founding the Michigan Applied Robotics Group. How did that come about for you?
So within most engineering schools, there exist build teams. And what they really are an opportunity for engineering students to go beyond the normal curriculum and really pursue their individual passions. At Michigan, back in 2006, there was a graduate professor who got funding from the Office of Naval Research in the U.S. Navy to develop self-driving submarines. There were a couple undergraduate students who wanted to get involved with the program but didn't quite have the same level of experience to do that, and so they started a team called UM Autonomy, which is the team that I'm a part of. And we create an autonomous boat. What ended up happening was those alumni graduated and end up being involved with Ford and Argo's self-driving team. They came back to UM Autonomy and a couple of the other autonomous robotics groups at the University of Michigan and said, hey, we put out this goal of putting self-driving vehicles on the road by 2021, but we know we're going to need more manpower to do it. And so, you know, we need to recruit people from everywhere, but we know, you know, being alumni, this is a good place to start. So they said, listen, we'd like to talk to all the teams at once, put a date together, and we'll talk. So we got all the teams together, and joking around, we realized we were facing a lot of the same problems, and it didn't make any sense that none of us were collaborating with each other. So as a result, the Michigan Applied Robotics Group was born as a result of students to be able to communicate similar problems that they were facing within autonomous vehicles, as well as it expanded, we realized there were a bunch of opportunities that being a combined umbrella organization allowed for.
What's one of your absolute favorite stories about creating one of the autonomous boats since you've been at University of Michigan?
Creating the autonomous boat has always been great because it's really been a fun community. People, unlike a lot of the graduate teams that we compete with, none of the undergraduates are paid. And so they're doing this simply because it's their passion. So anything from the logic to the vehicles themselves have always been just one problem after another. So one of the greatest situations was this program called SLAM. SLAM is Simultaneous Localization and Mapping, or basically going into a foreign environment, knowing nothing about it, and using all your sensor data to perceive it and create a three-dimensional image of it. Now, that's typically a graduate-level research project. But the way that our competition is structured and the way that self-driving vehicles are going, it's a technology that we're going to need to know and our members are going to need to know in order to be useful to their employers day one. And so we had a senior graduate this past winter who, as a senior design project, created the SLAM system for us. He then went off to Google, and one of the deals when you go to Google is you're not allowed to consult anybody on their computer science projects. And so he left us with a project that worked once, but we needed it to work in our competition in a variety of environments. And so ultimately, he left us with a system that had a couple of bugs in it and wasn't going to be able to function on its own. As a matter of necessity, we had a freshman and a sophomore in computer science spend 14-hour days working for a week, and they figured it out. Just tirelessly working on this thing until eventually it worked and we were able to utilize it in competition. And it speaks to the whole purpose of why the organization exists, where the problems were so obscene and so complicated, but it allows what would normally have computer science majors to have to graduate, go out into industry, and then come back to graduate school before they worked on a project, work on it at essentially the very beginning of when they were in the computer science curriculum and specialize.
I'm getting that you also had a lot of fun with solving the puzzle that was figuring out how to make the SLAM work.
It's a lot of long days and a lot of late nights, but engineering is different, I think, from a lot of other disciplines in that you know you can't do it as an individual. It is entirely team-based, and you are dependent on other people to work, and people have a lot of fun with it, and they're very welcoming as a result. You know, UM Autonomy welcomes freshmen with no experience all the way up to, you know, junior and senior level students who are just looking for that next step and to really specialize where a computer science or a mechanical engineering or a naval architecture program doesn't let them have the same opportunities.
Let's say that a freshman with no experience comes in right now, and now you've got to teach him or her, let's say her, because there aren't enough women in engineering yet, how to make an autonomous vehicle. What's the first thing you teach her?
Well, you know, we deal with this every year, and this is something, you know, I'm only a sophomore now, and so this is something that I was facing last year. And depending on what their experience levels were, I mean, we have four different sub-teams. One of them is AI, which comes with having an autonomous vehicle. One of them is electrical and connecting all the hardware. One of them is hulls and systems, which is physically constructing the hull of the boat and all the mechanical issues that we face. And one of them is business, which is really funding the team. And, you know, unfortunately, everybody needs that at a certain point. So one of the things that we really like to focus on with our initial members is asking them, you know, what are they interested in? If that answer is AI, they say, okay, so here are some projects that we need to have happen. You know, we have this functioning system in one programming language that we need to be converted to another. Do you think you can do that? And what ultimately we found is that, you know, you give people free rein to really be in control, and you kind of take a back seat, and when they want to have help, you give it to them. People have this aha moment where they're really able to explore, and as a result, not only do they increase their knowledge base rapidly, they also became really committed to the team. So if that's AI, that's coding on their own. If it's electrical, you know, electrical engineers, when they first come in, they think they're going to be soldering wires for the rest of their life. Ultimately, you show them a functioning boat from the previous year, and you say, okay, these are all the problems that we faced, and here are all the opportunities. And all of a sudden, they're redesigning a central motherboard, they're reconnecting wires to different systems, they're building a new vehicle entirely from scratch. And so even if you have a returning member, much less a new one, you're able to give them different opportunities than they had the previous year.
I love that right off the bat, you give them ownership and say, how do we customize this to you? That sounds like a winning team before it ever gets started.
Well, I mean, one of the things that we face in a lot of the build teams is people have restrictions on time. They don't join early. They join a little bit later. They have other interests. And so you're really bound by averaging people only to have for 18 months. And so in that 18 months, you got to take them from nothing all the way up to at that 18th month level. They're starting to train people underneath them. And so it's completely on your own will that you want to be there in the first place. And so you got to have people committed to the team, and you got to have them wanting on their own to be a member of it. And ultimately giving them ownership creates that kind of environment.
Let's look at some of the issues you're going to be dealing with as you make autonomous vehicles a reality. What are you facing, for example, in the legal area?
So in the legal area, one of the things that we're facing is, you know, there's no policy written on it. I found it really interesting talking to the people in Silicon Valley at Sensor Expo about their relationship with the auto industry and how Silicon Valley has really been born on phones and computers, which is, you know, a 12 to 2-year build cycle, while vehicles are 5 years from the initial conception all the way until being put on the road. And some of that has to do with all the regulatory, but a lot of that has to do with, you know, the actual safety of the vehicle itself and the complexity of it. And so I think one of the major issues we're going to face in legal is a lot of the public policymakers don't understand what data needs to be given to the public and what doesn't. So that's one of the things that we're really focusing on at MCity, and they're actually helping to advise National Highway Traffic and Safety Administration, as well as the Michigan Department of Transportation, on what legislation should be written. You know, what are reasonable expectations for companies having to give data to the public? How do we ensure that a vehicle is safe? And under what test situations can we prove that to be true? You know, Americans drive 3.2 trillion miles a year. That is an obscene number of different situations that any number of vehicle will encounter. And so to think that a couple thousand hours of testing in a small environment will be able to simulate it is irresponsible and irrational. And so really what needs to happen is we're trying to figure out what data needs to be transmitted and how much of the simulations need to be done with a real vehicle and how much of it can be done in computers.
There's also, I was thinking as you said that, living out here in Southern California, we certainly see a lot of, shall we say, original or creative drivers on our freeway. And that brings up, what about the social area? What kind of considerations do you have when you create an autonomous vehicle and conclude that maybe somebody on the freeway is sleepy, doesn't have the same economic background as the guy driving along in the Porsche, maybe doesn't like people who cut in front of him, things of that nature?
That's what's so interesting to me is that, you know, I actually don't think the largest problem we're going to face is going to be technical. I think getting people comfortable with autonomous vehicles is going to be the number one problem that everyone is going to face. So I work a part-time job as a server, and that allows me to talk to 10 or 15 tables a night that basically talk entirely about, you know, what are you doing at school? And I say, I'm working on autonomous vehicles and self-driving cars. And I get two reactions to it. The first one is excitement. They want to be able to sit back and read a book on their way to work. They want to be able to send their kids in a car and not have to drive them to soccer practice. But then I get the second reaction, and it's typically more prominent than the first, and it's apprehension about losing control. And so, yes, the technical problems are solvable, but it's going to be the social problems that I think are going to take the longest amount of time. Just from a technical level, it takes about 30 years for technology to be adopted in the automotive industry. And so I think what you're going to need to face, and it's already started to happen, is it's not going to be one day autonomous vehicles are on the road. It's going to be this progressive transition, and that's already started to happen. So, for instance, a couple years ago when Ford started allowing vehicles to parallel park themselves, or you're starting to have vehicles that have automatic braking or driver notification if a vehicle is starting to brake in front of them too quickly. And so that technology is already starting to happen, but you're still going to face a situation like you have in aviation where people are still inherently uncomfortable with flying. Or, you know, people are uncomfortable with certain levels of transportation. People are going to be uncomfortable with autonomous vehicles. And I think what Google, Uber, and GM are doing right now is really progressive, which is that just giving people free rides and giving them experience in a self-driving car. Because not only is that person realized, okay, this is viable, I feel comfortable in this, but also that person is going to talk to 30 other people about that experience. And so I think it's going to take time for people to become comfortable with it. And at what level are they comfortable with it?
That's such an interesting parallel. You surprised me when you said 30 years. But then I thought, yeah, planes. I remember a time when people really didn't fly that much and were kind of scared of planes. And now if you're traveling someplace, it's, let's call the airline. That sounds almost conservative now, 30 years to get the driverless cars on the road and widely accepted. What about the myths that you're hearing about autonomous vehicles in general versus the realities? What misconceptions do people have?
So one of the things that really sparked concern was the Tesla crash. And people really didn't understand it. All they saw was that a vehicle that was driving on its own crashed and killed the driver. And so I live in Chicago, and one of the things that I always think about when I drive back is right across the highway on 94, there is a sign that basically says, how many traffic deaths has there been this year? And the vast, vast majority of people never pay attention to it because you're not driving that vehicle. However, as soon as I'm in a self-driving car and I see that that one car crashes, that same computer in that car is in my car, and all of a sudden I have this extreme alarm to it. So without any data about what had happened, automatically, a huge number of people were turned off to autonomous vehicles. They started contacting legislature. There was all this alarm about what was happening. 2 years later, what ended up coming out, or a year and a half later, I guess, about that vehicle was that the driver had refused on multiple occasions to take control of the vehicle. What had happened was the cameras and the computer realized that it was not optimal conditions for it to be driving and said, listen, you know, the driver needs to take control of the vehicle in order to have it be safe. He refused. And what happened was the camera couldn't tell the difference between the back of a truck and the horizon, and it crashed into the vehicle. So people didn't realize that that actually wasn't the computer's fault. That was the human for rejecting to take control despite saying, this is for your own good, this is for your safety, you need to be driving this vehicle. And so that raises a couple other concerns about, well, the Tesla should have just pulled over and said, you don't have a choice but to take control. So, you know, that was perhaps the most major case. Misconceptions in particular, that they're not safe. Absolutely they're safe. You look at the, you know, the 35,000 people that die every year in automotive accidents in the U.S., and you compare that to the millions of miles that autonomous vehicles have already driven. I had seen something about Google's autonomous vehicles. The only time that they had gotten an accident was when they were in parking lots, and it was another human's error for backing into, say, one of Google driverless cars. A computer doesn't get distracted by a phone. A computer doesn't get distracted by a lot of the other stimulus in their environment. And so it's able to focus on multiple different tasks at once and ultimately be a safer vehicle.
I'm thinking a computer doesn't fall asleep. A computer doesn't have a fight with its boyfriend or girlfriend and get upset and then get behind the wheel. I could see where this could actually be preferable in a lot of ways. What's been one of your own best experiences riding in any autonomous vehicle, car, boat, or otherwise?
Perhaps my favorite one really has to go back to the whole idea of people being inherently afraid of losing control. So I was riding on Michigan's campus in one of the self-driving shuttles, which is called a Navi, which is it's a French company that has no steering wheel. And I was riding with one of the lab directors of MCity, and we were driving around. And the man has spent hundreds of miles driving at 15 miles an hour on this thing and is completely comfortable with it. And we're pulling up into the parking lot, and an old woman starts to walk across. And we get within 15 feet of it, and everyone's kind of like waiting to see how the vehicle reacts, and he hits the emergency stop button. Not because it was going to run her over, but just because even as somebody who is extremely comfortable and working on this technology, just had this apprehension about a computer making a decision. And so even though the vehicle had braked for everything else, it was still this apprehension about, is this really going to work? And so it speaks to not only is it just the general public that's somewhat afraid of self-driving vehicles, but even the people working on it, you know, have this inherent fear of losing control. And I think that's completely human of us. And so that's perhaps my favorite reality, has just been to see, you know what, this is real. There is a technological element where it can be proven over and over and over again, but we're still people, and we still have this relationship with vehicles and with computers. Your phone malfunctions. And that's fine, and you can't use your phone for a little period of time, but your car can't malfunction going 70 miles an hour down the road. And as a result of, you know, those two paradigms, we have this real fear of self-driving vehicles.
Before we leave the topic of issues facing the autonomous vehicles, what do you foresee as some of the issues when it comes to urban planning, to implementing them in cities over the next three decades?
So there was a very interesting conversation about a term called urban canyons. So the same way that if you're in a city and you're trying to use your phone to navigate from one place to another, and all of a sudden, you know, I'm trying to navigate to Starbucks and it says I'm three blocks over from my current location. You know, you can't have that same situation in an autonomous vehicle. And so I'm going to be in a self-driving car that's going to be reliant on GPS to a certain extent. And it's not going to know exactly where it is in the environment. And so we have to have some kind of an infrastructure in place to where we have more specific GPS where it's otherwise knocked out. I think that one is a really interesting problem to deal with. You have another situation where I was talking to a Ford engineer a couple weeks ago, where when you are merging in a lane, you rely on the drivers behind you, and you trust them not to hit you as soon as you start to display intent. An auto manufacturer, especially in a self-driving situation, if they crash, the auto manufacturer is responsible. And so they can't be dependent on the same thing that you and I are dependent on for merging. And they have to make sure 100% of the time when they merge, they're not going to be hit because otherwise they're liable. And so you really face the situation of that's one of the most difficult problems that they're facing is when do I display intent? When do I retreat back and give up on that maneuver? And how much do I trust other vehicles around me?
Let's imagine 10 years from today, given the trends that you're seeing, what do you think is going to be the role of autonomous vehicles in business?
I'll go back to when I was growing up and my dad in corporate fleet leasing. So we had a whole conversation about what does this really make possible? So in my dad's business, they typically dealt with 300,000 vehicles a year, all of which were corporate fleet and had different driving patterns. But roughly a quarter of those vehicles would get in an accident every year. Another third of those would typically be just from in parking lots. So we talked about, you know, what are the different situations when an autonomous vehicle take over? So whether it be getting in a parking lot and all of a sudden eliminating those crashes to a certain percentage, or something as simple as highway driving, where you just sit in from one lane to another, which exists with adaptive cruise control right now. But what we're in a situation is which you could return to a fleet driver 30% of the time that they're working because they're not driving, and they can sit back and they could do expense reports. They could be talking to clients. They could be multitasking. But you're giving them back that otherwise unused time. The same situation already exists in urban environments where many employers, say if you live in New York City, will give you the opportunity to, as soon as you get on the subway, you turn on your mobile hotspot and you open up your computer, that's working time. And so I think people are not going to be as concerned with living close to cities because you don't have to worry about your commute as much. All of a sudden, your commute is effective work time. And so I think you're no longer going to have this concentration of people in cities, but it's going to give them the opportunity to actually move out into cheaper neighborhoods and into quieter neighborhoods. And I think you're going to see this, you know, kind of anti-urbanization movement.
That's going to be an interesting thing, too. The anti-urbanization, perhaps people more in the suburbs or even rural areas due to autonomous vehicles. How do you see autonomous vehicles 10 years from today affecting recreation and leisure time?
So, you know, people have a relationship with cars on two levels. You know, on one level, they hate the idea of commuting. But on the other level, you know, people really enjoy the experience of driving. And so you've got to be able to give them both. And so I think, you know, with recreational time, all of a sudden I don't have to worry about, as expensive as it is, to travel a long distance with my family on vacation. I no longer have to have one of two adults or one adult driving the entire duration. And so all of a sudden it makes travel more cost effective. It allows me to, you know, we spend a lot of time up in northern Michigan. It's a 7-hour drive from Chicago. All of a sudden I can leave at 11 p.m. or midnight, fall asleep in the back of my car, and by the time I wake up at 6 in the morning, I can be there. And so I think it makes travel more accessible to people and also more cost-effective.
I'm kind of wondering, when you talk about falling asleep in the back of your car and waking up at your destination, do you foresee such a thing happening, let's say, 30 years from today with cruise ships, where you can cruise the Bahamas, for example, with nobody at the controls?
Well, That one is a little bit on a larger scale. And what's so interesting is you look at, you know, the rules of the road with vehicles, which is part of the reason why we work on a self-driving boat. You know, you are not faced with lane changes. You're not faced with as dense a population in your environment. And so with cruise ships, I mean, you ran into the situation where the freighter in Japan crashed into the U.S. naval destroyer. What the initial signs point to is that even 30 minutes after the collision, the vehicle kept going on autopilot. And so, yeah, you could reasonably run into a situation, but also you're starting to run into different rules of the road and all these different situations. One of the other things you face in, say, a boat of some kind that we face is drift. In a vehicle, for the vast portion, wherever your wheels are, that's where you're going to be. When you're in a boat, you're dealing with wind, you're dealing with currents, and all of a sudden you've got all these other variables at play, as well as a cruise ship's less maneuverable. And so I think it's absolutely viable, and I think something close to that is commercial shipping, where you can all of a sudden have these large caravans of shipping containers that are no longer needed to travel 8 or 10 hours a day, but can all of a sudden travel 20 hours a day, but at a lower speed and at a higher cost effectiveness.
You mentioned during the sensors conversation that weather and environment were factors. Obviously, in Michigan, it would be ice, sleet, and snow. What needs to be kept in mind as you're developing your vehicles there?
So that was one of the great things about being in Silicon Valley is I really hadn't spent a lot of time there, but I've entirely grown up in the Midwest. And in Silicon Valley, you have ideal test conditions. You have sun, you have two weather. You have sunny and you have cloudy, and that's it. In the Midwest, you have freezing rain, you have snow, you have fog. And so with a situation like a camera, just as you trying to drive down the road, you know, I can see through a blizzard or I can rely on, you know, lines in the road to depend on where I am. I can rely on the feel that the steering wheel gives me in order to drive in adverse conditions. But with things like LiDAR, I laugh because I was riding in one of the Navia shuttles at the beginning of April in Ann Arbor. And, you know, unlike in Silicon Valley, at the beginning of April in Ann Arbor, it's sleeting rain. And so snow would fly in front of the LiDAR sensor and all of a sudden it would bounce back as, oh my gosh, there's an object. Stop. And all of a sudden you have this shuddering motion moving forward. And the lab director just shook his head and goes, God, you just hate adverse weather. And it was such a human, real moment to be there and realize, you know, there are problems that are going to exist with this. And how do you sort through that? And what do you determine as a real object? Because the same way that, you know, snow will get on your glasses, all of a sudden, you know, it's a much bigger object than what it initially appears to be. And then it would melt away. And so you're going to face these situations where, whether it's on a computer science level or it's on an individual sensor level, how do I deal with these conditions? Now, at the exact same time, I got a reaction from a guy from Minnesota, which said, why would you be driving in a blizzard anyway? Which I thought was a pretty funny reaction to driving in adverse conditions. But it's real and something we face as drivers, and this isn't something, you know, engineers solve problems. It's just going to be another problem we're going to need to face.
Coming from back east, I'll be interested to see how you solve the problem of black ice, because that, with human drivers, is a real problem right now.
Right. And that's another one that we're working on at Michigan, is vehicles communicating to each other. So even if a vehicle in front of you skids 100 feet, it's able to transmit that information back to you and says, hey, pull over into the left lane. You know, we face this situation in the right lane. And so it's one of those things that drivers, as they exist right now, don't have that added safety net. But connected cars, not just fully autonomous, but connected cars are going to give us.
Before we have to wrap up here, Rourke, and thank you for your time, I'm going to brag about you a little bit, because your resume lists you as a Rogel China Scholarship recipient. Congratulations. You're going to be traveling to China, I believe, in the fall and learning about engineering there.
Yes, I am. Thank you so much.
Wow.
It's a Michigan engineer who's been extremely generous with the university, and I'm headed over there for the fall. So a couple of our sponsors from UM Autonomy have bases in China. So I'm still hoping to be really connected with the team while I'm over there.
What are some of the technologies you'll be most interested in exploring in China that you may ultimately wind up applying to U.S. automotive technology once you return?
So in China, they're really great about being cost effective. So that technology like LiDAR, where you're facing something that's $8,000 and now it's starting to get into the $500 realm, I think that'll be really impressive to see how they can produce it cost effectively and at mass. At the exact same time, you know, China has such a focus on building infrastructure. You know, a lot of the research programs we're doing at Michigan are what sensors can you have in the environment. And I think it'll be really interesting to see, you know, what the willingness is there, what the relationship with automotive is there. And likewise, in America, we're fairly resistant to changes, I think, in a lot of these areas, whether it be automotive, whether it be telecom. And in China, they don't have that same background, and so they're welcome to it. It just becomes the original normal for them. And so I think it'll be really interesting to see what is the relationship with automotive over there, as well as what are markets that exist in China that are not as significant in the U.S.? And likewise, what can we take from China and bring here?
I see from your resume that you'll be getting your BS in electrical engineering in 2020. What's your ultimate goal? If you could have anything happen right now for you in your career creating autonomous vehicles, what would you be doing in 5 years?
It's hard to say when you're an undergraduate, because things are changing so fast, with both in autonomous vehicles, but just within my own relationships at school. And so I think, you know, working on some area of autonomous vehicles, whether it be actually working out in the heavy technical and the research for a period of time, or perhaps working on much more of a larger industry-wide level. So talking about not just autonomous vehicles and the technology itself, but what does it make possible? You know, what if you own a vehicle, do I really need it between the hours of 11 p.m. and 6 a.m. when I'm asleep? Or do I really need it between the hours of, you know, 9 a.m. and 4 p.m. while I'm at work? You know, could I lease out my vehicle to Amazon? Maybe starting a business like that, where I'm managing a fleet of individual consumers' vehicles, and I'm leasing it to Amazon or Whole Foods for a period of time and doing deliveries. Or I'm leasing it to Uber for a period of time and allowing them to drive other people around in the city. Or do I have it do my own tasks for me, like go out and pick up my dry cleaning, etc.? Starting a business like that, or starting a business focusing on how do I, that 30-year number. You know, one of the things that we talked about was most technologies, like, say, power windows, took 30 years to adapt onto vehicles. But at the exact same time, technology like ABS brakes, where not just U.S. regulators, but the insurance industry of all people saw how beneficial it was for their drivers to have ABS brakes, that they subsidized it and made it economical. And so rather than a 30-year window for that technology to be adapted, it was a 5-year window. And so likewise, what technologies could you make, whether it be just highway driving, where I give you back 30% of your working time just for having this technology added onto your vehicle? Or if I gave you the opportunity to where your car drove less than 5 miles an hour in a parking lot and all of a sudden it parked itself, you know, now I'm avoiding those 30% of accidents that occur in parking lots. You know, I could see myself working on a business like that, but, you know, who knows where the world's going to go. I'm excited to be a part of it.
And if you'd like to know more about the University of Michigan's autonomous boats and other self-driving vehicles, you're invited to get involved.
Our website is umautonomy.com. And if anyone, whether they're at the University of Michigan, a company looking to be involved, or just students who want to talk about what are some of the opportunities at Michigan, Our website is on there, and my email is on there. I'd be happy to talk to anybody that's interested.
YumaAutonomy.com. Let's tempt them just a little bit, if you have the time for this.
Certainly.
And tell them what are some of the opportunities they might get involved with when they check that website.
So YumaAutonomy.com really gives some of the history about the team, both from the previous years and some of the projects that we're working on. A lot of the, we don't have quite as much detail up there as we need, but everybody is super welcoming on the team. And I'm sure if you emailed our president, myself as vice president, or even many of the sub-team leads, they'd be happy to talk about their specific categories.
And there's also some really neat articles on there. When did you implement your shuttles, your autonomous shuttles you were referencing?
So the autonomous shuttles were actually just announced midway through this summer. Navia has been a smaller French company that actually just announced that they were opening up a plant in southeastern Michigan. I think they're going to try to open up this fall, but they're one of the technologies that has been doing research at M-City, and they have been focused on improving a lot of their technology, but also because exactly like we had talked about, some of the weather conditions that are not normal for other environments, Michigan has all four seasons, and that's really where we've been benefiting. And so a lot of the research that they're doing is not only just to provide shuttle service and transportation for the University of Michigan, but to do research on how do people react to different situations within a self-driving vehicle when they don't have control of it.
If people could only get one thing from you about innovation, creativity, and making a difference as you're part of a world that's a really exciting one, what would you want them to get from you?
Wow. Engineering and innovation exists to benefit people. And I think that should be your number one reason why you're in engineering, is because you see a way to make the world healthier, safer, better. Be involved in innovation and do things the right way. You know, automotive takes 5 years to create a new vehicle because they're concerned about safety, and consumer safety is the number one thing. Do it because you care about it and you care about benefiting people with your technology, not because you're in it for the money or in it to be first. Do it because it's right. And I'd say that's probably my biggest focus on innovation right now.
Rourke, thank you for your time today.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
You and I have been listening to Rourke Petullo, co-founder of the University of Michigan's Michigan Applied Robotics Group, Bachelor's of Engineering candidate at the university, and Vice President of UM Autonomy. You'll find more information about University of Michigan's autonomous boats and other vehicle projects at umautonomy.com, and you're invited to get involved. Again, that's umautonomy.com. And safe journey to Rourke as he embarks on his travels to China for this upcoming semester. We'll look forward to hearing a lot more from him on the future of autonomous vehicles. And that concludes this edition of Over Coffee. Thank you for listening. Subscribe to Over Coffee at 2mavericks.com. That's 2, T-W-O, Mavericks, M-A-V-E-R-I-X, 2mavericks.com. The music you're hearing is royalty-free production music provided by Pond5 at pond5.com. I'm Dot Cannon. Here's wishing you a cappuccino day.